It is 5 hours Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
U.S. report concludes CIA tortured suspected terrorists. Russia resumes gas supplies to Ukraine. I'm Ray Kugel reporting from Washington. A U.S. Senate report says a Central Intelligence Agency tortured suspected terrorists following the 2001 terror attacks on the U.S. while conducting interrogations that repudiated the country's values. The Senate Intelligence Committee released a report Tuesday that said the CIA mistreated prisoners it suspected of terrorism and misled Congress and the American people about the effectiveness of the enhanced techniques it used. They included confinement in small places, sleep deprivation, and waterboarding, which simulates drowning. Senate Intelligence Committee Chairperson Senator Dianne Feinstein defended the release of the report, saying the CIA had violated U.S. law and U.S. values.
History will judge us by our commitment to a just society governed by law and the willingness to face an ugly truth and say never again.
President Obama says the harsh methods do not serve the country's broader counterterrorism efforts or its national security interests, and he would make sure the U.S. does not resort to those methods again. French President François Hollande says his country's last hostage, Sergei Lazarevich, is free after being held for almost 3 years by Al-Qaeda's North Africa branch. The 50-year-old Frenchman, who was kidnapped in northern Mali, appeared Tuesday and met with reporters at the French embassy in Niger's capital, Niamey. His release immediately raised questions about what concessions the French government may have made in order to secure his freedom from Al-Qaeda and the Islamic Maghreb. This is VOA News. Zimbabwe's President Robert Mugabe fired the Vice President Joyce Mujuru and at least seven government ministers seen as her allies. While agreeing to step down, the Vice President denied accusations she was plotting to oust the President from office and said she'll remain a loyal member of the ruling ZANU-PF party. Energy-starved Ukraine battling pro-Russian separatists near the Russian border began receiving its first cross-border natural gas shipments since Moscow cut off supplies last June in a bitter price dispute. Resumption of supplies from Russia comes as Ukrainian troops and rebel forces observed a so-called day of silence in a push to revive a ceasefire that broke down within hours of its September 5th start date. Authorities say truce talks could begin this Friday. Outgoing U.S. Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel met with top Iraqi officials in Baghdad Tuesday. It was an unannounced visit. After Iranian report, Secretary Hagel came with a message for the Iraqis.
Defense Secretary Hagel met with a group of 200 American and Australian troops on the first segment of his visit, telling them that it is ultimately up to Iraq to defend and support itself.
We can train, we can assist, we can advise, and we're doing that.
A statement from the Iraqi Prime Minister's office indicated that Baghdad is seeking to buy more weapons from the U.S. to defend itself and also hopes to get more U.S. air support for Iraqi ground forces. Edward Uranian, Cairo.
The United Nations says member states have agreed to take in more than 100,000 Syrian refugees from neighboring host countries, doubling previous resettlement offers. Norway's Nobel Committee is preparing to present its annual Peace Prize to a Pakistani teenage girl and an Indian man today. VOA's Alpesin has details.
17-year-old Malala Yousafzai from Pakistan was nearly killed by the Taliban 2 years ago for her advocacy for girls' education. 60-year-old Kailash Satyarthi of India founded a charity that frees bonded child laborers and provides them with training and education. Malala invited the prime ministers of the two countries to Wednesday's award ceremony, but they've not responded.
I would have thought of it as a big opportunity to ask them to have good relationships and to make education together their top priority and work on it together.
Alpesin, VOA News, London.
Hong Kong police are warning protesters they have until Thursday to clear the territory's remaining protest sites. That could bring an end to more than 2 months of pro-democracy demonstrations. Police are set to move in after a ruling by Hong Kong's High Court gave them the okay. I'm Ray Kugel in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Bate in Washington. Today is Wednesday, December 10th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Sierra Leone President Ernest Bai Koroma has assured striking doctors that their concerns will be addressed.
They agreed they are going to go back to work because they have received the firm commitment from His Excellency the President that their welfare demands they put forward are going to be addressed immediately.
Abdoulaye Birete is Sierra Leone's government spokesman. Residents of Kenya's Rift Valley react to ICC's dismissal of charges against President Kenyatta. Persistent power outages take a toll on South Africa's economy, and Zimbabwe's dismissed vice president breaks her silence.
I am not a fighting character. When you receive an order from your senior, you carry it out right through. If you have anything to question about that order, you find your way of questioning it.
That's Zimbabwe's ousted Vice President Joyce Mujuru. We'll also have a report on other cabinet ministers fired along with Mrs. Mujuru. On this International Human Rights Day, the U.S. has the highest prison population in the world. Those stories plus Mark Oldman's portion of our Listener of the Day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Sierra Leone's President Ernest Bai Koroma has assured doctors who have been on a partial strike over the lack of proper care for local Ebola caregivers that their demands will be met. About 106 medical personnel have died from Ebola in Sierra Leone, including 10 doctors, three of them as recently as last week. The doctors say they want a specialized Ebola unit equipped with a dialysis machine to treat them whenever they are infected by their patients. They also said they want an insurance policy. Government spokesman Abdoulaye Birete says President Koroma met with the doctors on Tuesday and assured them that their demands will be addressed immediately.
As a matter of point, His Excellency the President met with the junior doctors today at State House, wherein they discussed some of the concerns, one of those being they wanted more protection in terms of their colleagues who have died in the hands of Ebola. And they said they become scared because they also wanted some insurance policy. So the president, of course, recognized the invaluable role they are playing and recognized that all the efforts they are making in the fight against Ebola is more of a nationalistic sacrifice they are making. But that notwithstanding, government is also going to respect their views and address the welfare demands they put forward, including insurance policy.
As you know, the latest report indicates that Ebola continued to thrive heavily in some parts of Sierra Leone. How soon would the government act?
In fact, the president in the meeting gave decisive instructions that their demands must be addressed immediately because they should be of priority. And it is unfortunate, though, because this is the first time the junior doctors have gone on strike, and they gave us a very limited notice. Because, as you know, the fight against Ebola, in as much as government is pulling all its resources alongside its international development partners, it is a new disease for us, and that is why we emphasize, even for our frontline health workers, that they must respect universal infection protection control. And they also recognize the efforts government is making in terms of the Chinese establishing for us a center for disease control in Sierra Leone, which can continue to provide training for our healthcare workers.
So, Abdoulaye, the doctors say to President Koroma that they are going to return to work?
Yes, they agreed they are going to go back to work because they have received the firm commitment from His Excellency the President that their welfare demands they put forward are going to be addressed immediately.
You have lost 10 doctors to the Ebola virus. So one would say, yes, it's reasonable for the doctors to say they need more protective equipment. Can you empathize with the doctors?
Indeed, we can. And in fact, when they met with His Excellency the President today, the executive did raise the issue about, apart from the protective equipment, they also wanted a dialysis machine. They wanted a complete ICU ward so that any of them that might have contracted the virus, at least there will be some guarantee that that person will receive adequate care. And we have already, as a government, contacted the emergency hospital. They have agreed that all what they've requested for will be in country around the 17th of this month. Then the installations and everything will be up and running by the 20th of this month.
Sierra Leone's government spokesman Abdoulaye Birete was speaking with me from the capital, Freetown. Zimbabwe President Robert Mugabe has fired Vice President Joyce Mujuru and at least seven cabinet ministers, all said to be allies of the former deputy president. According to President Mugabe, Mrs. Mujuru and her allies were allegedly plotting to overthrow the 90-year-old president. In this exclusive interview with Viewers Zimbabwe Service, Mrs. Mujuru, once seen as a possible successor to the aging president, said she has complied with the president's decision to fire her.
Very true. I received it last night at 9:31 p.m. that I was no longer the vice president of Zimbabwe with immediate effect, full stop. And he quoted section 106(1)(b), which I tried to check in the constitution and I didn't get it. There's only section 1. Maybe he wanted to say section 2(b).
And what did you say you did?
In fact, he was saying you were doing things that were not supposed to be done by yourself, which include, maybe if you can give me a second so that I can say what it says. This I'm now reading from 2(b) of the Constitution because there is no 1(b). It says conduct of vice president, ministers or deputy ministers act in any way that is inconsistent with their office or expose themselves to any situation involving the risk of a conflict between their official responsibilities and private interests. And those are the things, if I am given a chance to meet our committee in the party, those are the things that they should ask me to explain, if they have them, that I have been doing.
Have you accepted the order by the president to step down?
I am not a fighting character. My background, I'm a trained person. When you receive an order from your senior, you carry it out right through. If you have anything to question about that order, you find your way of questioning it. I signed for that letter. I even wrote a letter of acknowledgement and even thanking him for his immense contribution in my life. And that's how we were taught in ZANLA. That's how we were brought up in ZANU PF.
What about your position in the party? Are you going to remain a member of ZANU PF or you are considering opting out?
I am, mind you, I don't know any other party other than ZANU PF. And that's my party. And I will die in ZANU PF.
Do you feel safe in Zimbabwe, judging from the attacks that we have seen and some party youths threatening you and your families?
Zimbabwe is my country. And mind you, whatever has been going on, I had not been able to give my side of story to the people. Only today I managed to release my second statement to the papers, trying to give a bit of the narration of the other side of story. So with time, people will begin to see what really went wrong.
That was Zimbabwe's dismissed Vice President Joyce Mujuru speaking with Blessing Zulu of VOA's Zimbabwe Service. Also fired yesterday, along with Zimbabwe Vice President Joyce Mujuru, were seven cabinet ministers and one deputy. They had been accused of incompetency and publicly vilified for allegedly plotting to overthrow President Robert Mugabe. Thomas Cheripasi has more from Harare.
In a statement released by the Chief Secretary to the President in Cabinet, Mr. Mugabe used Section 108, Subsection 1, Part A of the new Constitution to dismiss the ministers, saying their conduct and performance was below his expected standards. One of the sacked ministers, Dzikamai Mavaire, was cheeky when contacted for comment, but later thanked Mr. Mugabe for affording him an opportunity to serve in his cabinet. This is not the first time that Mavaire has fallen out of favor with Mr. Mugabe. In 1998, he was fired from the ruling party and government when he called for the president to resign due to his advanced age. Meanwhile, political analyst George Makoni, who is also the program's officer of the Center for Community Development in Zimbabwe, said ZANU-PF bigwigs are playing what he called a cat-and-mouse game.
I think it is just confirming the voices of alternative views, which were saying ZANU-PF is corrupt, it is a murderous party, because the charges are really tallying with that, in the sense that if you look particularly at Maimjuru, they are raising issues to do with planning to assassinate the president and allegations of corruption, issues which were mainly being said by the alternative voices. So they've just confirmed that in ZANU-PF it was there.
Former president of the Zimbabwe National Students Union, Pride Mukono, told Studio 7 that the firing of Mujuru and the ministers, who are allegedly perceived to be siding with him, shows that Mr. Mugabe will now decide on his succession without the involvement of other players like Mrs. Mujuru.
I think, firstly, this has been a long time coming. I think it has been clear since the entry of Grace Mugabe into politics that move was what would be the last trump card for Robert Mugabe and the other faction within ZANU-PF. But what now means is that it's clear that the succession matrix has remained wide open, because Robert Mugabe is keeping everyone guessing on who will take over.
Political analyst and veteran journalist Sidney Masamvu says ZANU-PF is now more divided than ever. Reporting for Studio 7 from Harare, this is Thomas Chiripasi.
It is Wednesday morning, December 10th, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington, and please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time is coming up at 17 minutes past the hour. Last week, the International Criminal Court prosecutor dropped crimes against humanity charges against Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta, citing a lack of evidence. From Kenya's Rift Valley, viewers Gabe Jaslow reports on how the decision is being viewed by those displaced by the 2007 post-election violence that Mr. Kenyatta has been accused of organizing.
It is hard, bruising work that pays next to nothing. Half a truckload of gravel goes for less than $17. But it is the only work available at the Kehodo Displaced Persons Camp outside Naivasha, Kenya, where more than 100 families live on less than half a hectare of land nestled in the Rift Valley. All were displaced by ethnic clashes that followed the 2007 presidential election and led to International Criminal Court charges against President Uhuru Kenyatta and his deputy, William Ruto. People here have been waiting for years to receive compensation or resettlement. Now that the ICC prosecutor, Fatou Bensouda, has dropped charges against President Kenyatta, some think the government will be more free to help. A camp leader, Jeffrey Mwara, wants the charges against William Ruto dropped as well, saying the cases have distracted the country from more important issues.
Only that, if they will drop the charges and hold the government of Kenya responsible to resettle all IDPs, that can work.
At first, many victims welcomed ICC investigators, hoping the court would bring closure to a tragic episode in Kenya's history. But some say the process was too political and prosecutors went after the wrong guys.
Ms. Bensouda has wrong suspects, wrong evidence, and wrong witnesses. And the three wrong things cannot make charges to succeed.
More than 600,000 people were displaced by the violence that followed the disputed election between then-President Mwai Kibaki and opposition candidate Raila Odinga. Of those displaced, some 40,000 are still unsettled, an issue that was not discussed enough by the ICC, according to Kefa Mageni, program coordinator for a Kenyan NGO working with IDPs.
We have dealt with the question of suspects. That's okay. The case has been dropped. I don't know the consideration that they took into focus, but now there's also the question of the victimhood. So the reason why I should say the issue of the victim has been ignored all along.
The case against Deputy President Ruto and a co-accused is still underway at the Hague Court, but for many victims, trust in the court has faded, and any justice that can be delivered may be too little, too late. Gabe Joselo, VOA News, in Kenya's Rift Valley.
South Africa's businesses and households have been crippled as the country's sole power utility, Eskom, intensified controlled power cuts in an effort to prevent a total collapse of the grid. As Gillian Parker reports from Johannesburg, for nearly a week, the state utility has intermittently reduced power supply by as much as 4,000 megawatts.
Eskom CEO Thandiwe Motona said Monday South Africans should brace themselves for another 18 months of power supply troubles. 3 weeks of tight electricity supply culminated in rolling blackouts during the weekend, which Eskom says were attributed to the utility neglecting to order enough diesel to fire emergency gas turbines used to generate power when the system is stressed. Monday's announcement riled businesses and residents, who are beginning to count the cost of the worst case of controlled power cuts they have seen. Johannesburg coffee shop manager Kareem Jones says the business has been engulfed in darkness every night for the past 4 days, forcing staff cuts as customers go elsewhere. Profits on Saturday night, she says, were down by half.
It's affecting jobs, it's affecting business, it's affecting customer services. And we bake at night, so it affects our baking. My bakers can't be baking between 6 and 10, then what's the point of having the staff between 6 and 10? What's the point of keeping those bakers on?
Eskom, which supplies more than 95% of the country's power, has intensified managed blackouts as delays in new plant openings stretch its aging 27 plants to breaking point. South Africa's power infrastructure has suffered from mismanagement and underinvestment. Producing electricity below cost is financially unsustainable, Eskom says, and partly to blame for the outages. Motona told journalists, "We have run our plants very hard, and not having done proper maintenance in the past has now come to haunt us." Some analysts estimate the blackouts have reduced economic growth significantly, costing the economy $44.4 billion since 2008. The retail, automotive and manufacturing sectors in South Africa have been hardest hit, say economists. The Steel and Engineering Industries Federation of Southern Africa said that power outages were totally unacceptable. The Federation estimates the crisis has cost the metals and engineering sectors $520 million. The Federation says poor power supply is likely to damage South Africa's reputation as an investment destination, causing untold harm to the economy. Electricity will continue to be intermittent until the Medupi and Kazili power stations start producing. Medupi is expected to be online in January, but full power production from both plants could take up to 18 months. Gillian Parker for VOA News, Johannesburg.
In observance of International Human Rights Day today, Wednesday, VOA has decided to look at the incarceration rates in the United States. Human rights groups often criticize the United States for having the largest prison population in the world. They argue that the U.S. courtrooms consistently hand out disproportionately long sentences for nonviolent crimes. As Jeff Swicore reports, after 30 years of get tough on crime policies, both conservatives and liberals are beginning to agree that it is time for reform.
In April of 1998, twins Lawrence and Lamont Garrison were convicted of cocaine distribution. Under mandatory minimum sentencing guidelines, which bypass a judge's discretion, they served 12 and 14 years in prison. Experts say a typical judge would have given them less than 5 years. To this day, Lamont Garrison maintains their innocence.
And they said, "Okay, Mr. Garrison, it's your opportunity, you know, to help yourself." And I said, "Well, help myself out. You know, what do you mean? Well, you know what this is about. You guys were doing wrong, X, Y, Z. You got to tell us what you were doing." I said, "Well, I wasn't doing anything wrong, so it's nothing to talk about."
Human rights organizations have often criticized the U.S. for ignoring the basic principles of justice and rendering disproportionately severe punishment. Mark Maurer is the executive director of the Sentencing Project.
The incarceration rates started to go up in the 1970s, but they really took off in the 1980s with the start of what came to be known the tough-on-crime movement, mandatory sentencing, basically political initiatives designed to send more people to prison, keep them there for longer periods of time.
The intention was to target violent criminals, but tough sentencing guidelines began to creep into nonviolent, often drug-related offenses. 30 years later, the incarceration rate has increased 500%. The more than 2 million people now incarcerated in the U.S. make up the largest prison population in the world. Mark Maurer says the long prison sentences send ripple effects through society.
When a person's sent off to prison, it's not just that person who's affected, but his or her family. So at the very least, the children have the psychological loss of a parent who's behind bars, the shame, the stigma that often goes along with that.
The collateral effect has triggered bipartisan calls for reform. Michael Barone is with the conservative American Enterprise Institute.
The conservatives said, what can we do to improve this? And one of the things they thought of, well, you know, if we don't impose criminal records or long, protracted jail sentences on people who are not violent felons or whose crimes are of minimal damage to society, then perhaps we will have better family formation.
There is a bipartisan movement in Congress to reduce mandatory sentences, but that will be left up to the Republican-controlled House and Senate in the next session. Jeff Swicord, VOA News, Washington.
It's time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Mark Owuma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Very good Wednesday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa Sports News, we begin with football. Chad surprised hosts Equatorial Guinea 2-1 in the semifinals at the Central Africa Economic and Monetary Community CEMAC Cup in Bata on Tuesday. The Republic of Congo edged Cameroon 2-1 in the capital Malabo to book their place in Saturday's final. The CEMAC Cup is an annual regional tournament featuring national teams made up of home-based players from Cameroon, Central African Republic, Chad, the Republic of Congo, Equatorial Guinea and Gabon. In Tanzania, Burundi pipped hosts Tanzania 2-1 in a friendly match played in Dar es Salaam on Tuesday. The encounter was part of Tanzania's 53rd independence celebration. This is Burundi's third triumph over Tanzania in as many matches this year. In the earlier encounters, Burundi prevailed with scores of 3-0 and 2-0. Elsewhere, Morocco's Maghreb Tetouan tackle New Zealand's Auckland City FC at the start of the FIFA Club World Cup in the capital Rabat today, Wednesday. Algeria's Entente Setif, Argentina's San Lorenzo, Australia's WS Wanderers, Mexico's Cruz Azul, and Spain's Real Madrid are the other teams vying for the world's top club football trophy over the next 10 days. In handball, Kenya Defense Force beat Rwanda's Police 35-30 in the men's contest at the Eastern Central Africa Handball Club Championships in Nairobi, Kenya on Tuesday. Uganda's Prisons outplayed Kenya's Strathmore University 29-23, and the Democratic Republic of Congo's Police dismissed Nairobi, Kenya University's Sports Association 32-27. In an all-Kenya women's encounters, Black Mamba pipped Serials 29-28, and Nairobi Water outclass Sparklers 34-16. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Omer in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a great day. Here's our listener mail for this Wednesday morning, the 10th day of December.
Voice of America, good morning. This ML Secure from Queen Elizabeth Road, right there in which I've got Freetown, Sweden. I just want to thank you guys out there for giving us the positive information on Ebola, as we are presently in the capital of Sierra Leone, experiencing a hype in the infection of Ebola every day, you know what I mean? So we just want to thank you guys for giving us the necessary information. Although we're getting our day from the Ministry of Health, I think yours is actually making us aware of the disease. And once more, thank you very much. This MSO from Sierra Leone, West Africa, Freetown. Thank you. Bye.
That's it for this edition of Daybreak Africa. I'm James Butte in Washington saying have a lovely day.
Next time on Straight Talk Africa, an in-depth discussion on the continent's fight against terrorist groups, Boko Haram and Al-Shabaab. That's next time on VOA Africa. celebrate the sounds of Africa today, yesterday, and tomorrow. That's our mission in your show, Music Time in Africa. Hello, I'm your host, Heather Maxwell. Join me every Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC and discover the best Pan-African music in the world. We play it all right here. Only the best on VOA Africa.